Welcome to Cornell's East Asia Conversations, a podcast that captures the latest thinking on issues of contemporary and historical East Asia. We share stories, experiences, and research grounded in multidisciplinary approaches to East Asian and international studies. This podcast is produced by the Cornell East Asia Program in Urus Hall Room 140 here on the Cornell campus.
I think China is a really interesting kind of place to study social media in the countryside, particularly because basically, you know, so often in China, the internet is seen as being an urban thing, right? And, you know, the vast majority of studies about the internet in China, you know, focus on, you know, government policies around the internet, how companies use the internet, and how users make use of the thing. But these users are almost always, you know, urban people. They're almost always middle class educated people. And, you know, for me, the jarring thing about that is that that just does not reflect the reality of internet use.
We are very happy to welcome Professor Tom McDonald to Cornell today. He is visiting us as one of the speakers in our Contemporary China Initiative speaker series, and is the last speaker in our semester-long theme about rural and urban integration or rural and urban relationships in China. And so we're very pleased to have had this opportunity to talk about this topic over some sort of more extended period of time. Tom is currently a professor in the Department of Sociology at Hong Kong University. Mm-hmm. He earned his PhD from University College London in the Department of Anthropology, graduating in 2013, I believe, 2013. And then there were a couple of years where you were doing research in China on a postdoc.
That's correct, yeah.
In rural China. Yeah. And then joined the faculty there in Hong Kong University in 2015. Mm. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And Tom has a book that's of great interest to us because of this topic, Social Media in Rural China, which looks at various aspects of social media, but it was here invited here to speak particularly about money, electronic money and electronic payment formats, and the impact of that, the social world in which that sort of thing transpires, particularly in rural or in migrant settings in China. So welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me on the podcast. It's wonderful to be here, and thanks for the great introduction and also for squeezing me in at the end of the semester.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So the first thing that I would be interested in hearing you talk a little about is to say something about how your work fits this theme that we have about rural and urban relationships or integrations.
As you kind of mentioned, my previous work was looking at kind of social media and how it was being used in rural China, you know, and obviously the book has come out in that, and that was part of a bigger project based at UCL called Huawei Post. So we were looking at kind of, you know, social media basically in small places around the world. I think China is a really interesting kind of place to study social media in the countryside, particularly because basically, you know, so often in China, the internet is seen as being an urban thing, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, the vast majority of studies about the internet in China, you know, focus on, you know, government policies around the internet, how companies use the internet, and how users make use of the thing. But these users are almost always, you know, urban people. They're almost always middle class educated people. And, you know, for me, the jarring thing about that is that that just does not reflect the reality of internet use. You know, now an enormous portion of the users of the internet in China or users of social media are from the countryside. You know, these platforms have been taken and they've been appropriated in ways that are really distinctive, and the, you know, distinctive kinds of patterns of use. Yeah, so I think one of the really interesting things is this, you know, this fixation and this idea that the internet is an urban thing, and that, you know, rural society does not necessarily have it or possess it, you know, just doesn't reflect the reality of, you know, the enormous numbers of people in the countryside who are adopting the internet or adopting social media, adopting these communication technologies, you know, and that also that they are developing distinctive practices, methods of use, or they are using them in ways that really speak to their unique positions in society and the particular challenges that they might face in their everyday life. And then, yeah, the other strand, I suppose, of the research that also speaks to this rural and urban integration is that since joining Hong Kong U, kind of my mode of doing research has inevitably changed, and kind of the focus of my research, as you have shorter periods to do research. So I've started looking more at, you know, people who have come out of the countryside and gone to the city, their kind of continued use of technology, of new monetary platforms, new kinds of credit services and things like that, you know, and really being interested in some of the issues as they, you know, face this challenge of themselves having to integrate the rural and the urban within their own life. So, you know, migration is motivated not just by, you know, earning more money in a city, it's motivated by the new opportunities, new experiences that might open up to them. But equally, they are, you know, having to maintain rural relationships either with other rural migrants who are also in the cities or with the people they know who they've left behind. So, you know, for me, there is this, you know, great question of, you know, these other kinds of integration that are going on a much more individual and personal basis.
Great. So I understand that to some extent this interest in social media and all grew out of a larger project, right? That that you were just a one local example of, I guess. But it would be nice for us to hear you talk maybe at a higher level about your sort of entry into the whole discipline of anthropology, or maybe your entry into an interest in China more generally, or the rural, any of those that you could help us understand a little more about how people come to those decisions.
Thanks for the great question. I mean, it's funny because it's only now you asked me this question for the first time. You know, I really realize how it's difficult to separate out the two, China and anthropology, from each other for me, right? In my kind of personal trajectory, it's difficult to, you know, it's difficult to trace which came first. So, you know, a long, long time ago when I was very young, my ambition was to be an actor. If I had gone to drama school, my entire life would probably be one extended audition. So at the time, I mean, my father had been kind of going out with his work. He'd been going out to China, and he just advised me. He said, you know, think about going to China because it's going through a remarkable transition. I hadn't been anywhere outside Europe before then, and this was my first experience of a radically different culture, if you like. So I was stuck in China. You know, and in my head, I had no idea. I didn't understand how people were acting, you know, why they were acting the way they did. And at the same time, I started reading, you know, anthropology, and it struck me as incredibly clear that this was a discipline and a subject that really gave you a toolkit to try to understand societies and cultures that seemed, very different from your own.
That's wonderful. That's very helpful. Thank you. And I want to give you a chance to say a little something about not just the work that you've done and been here to share with us, but what's coming up for you, what maybe some of the interests or topics that you're going to be carrying forward for the next few years.
You know, I feel like my participants are leading me along every time I do my research, that, you know, they give me a little like tidbit or a little like bit of information or a little opinion. And suddenly it's like a door opens into the next thing. And I'm like, oh, okay, here's a project. So, you know, as we've been talking over the last day or two, I mean, this last project that I've been working on has really kind of been looking at just generally the kinds of use and attitudes towards digital money that have been held by migrant workers, and how that that's been affecting their practices and their ideas around money. So originally the whole intention of that study was to kind of look at things like remittances and savings and investment. In the end, actually, you know, our work has kind of pushed us towards things that we just never imagined. So, you know, one of the things that has ended up becoming really important and interesting that was never there before was this issue of credit. In hindsight, I should have known it, because credit has always been this big thing in Chinese society, and there's always been particular practices around credit. So there's always been a long history of informal lending between people, of things like rotating credit societies or rotating credit associations and things like that. But actually what really amazed us about in the most recent research was that a group of our factory worker participants were really actively using services like Ant Credit Pay and Ant Cash Now, which are based, which are part of Zhima Credit, which is often, often called Sesame Credit in Western press and writing, which is all part of the Alipay platform. Mm. So what was really interesting is, we were blown away by a small group of our workers who seem to know everything about this platform. They seem to be very keen to kind of grow their credit score, increase their credit score. For me, this was like a penny dropping moment. It seemed to speak to one of these really major changes, because, many of these workers were adamant that, that either banks wouldn't give them credit, or that they could get credits from banks but they didn't want it because it was too much trouble, and they would only ever be given a small amount of money. And of course many banks in China are state-owned enterprises. But what was happening is, Alipay was saying to these users, purely based on their use of Alipay and their purchases on Taobao and all this big data that they had, was now telling these users, we'll allow you to, borrow to purchase things on credit, for maybe an interest-free period of a month, and these are only ever small purchases. But for me, there was this really interesting moment, because, I saw for a second very clearly that Alipay was managing to do something that banks just could not, right? And that, for many workers, this was, one of the first occasions when they were getting money from what we might call formal financial institutions, even though there's lots of problems with that distinction between formal and informal. I think that was just so interesting that, there was just something about the way this was being propositioned to workers and the way they felt about their relationship with Alipay that meant that they were able to, they were comfortable taking on their debt when they're normally so cautious and wary of bad debt. So The future kind of direction is really to kind of look at this issue of credit and this issue of these new forms of lending that are emerging in China, but really again there's a hope to kind of link that to a bigger issue, because I think you can't isolate that down to credit on its own and credit as being just simply a form of lending, because that thing that's going on with Alipay is also happening in a moment where the meaning of credit in China is massively in flux. So the government, we were talking about yesterday, the government is trying to introduce this new form of social credit, and it has proposed it and said that it's coming. Alipay, WeChat are developing their own kinds of credit, like local governments are developing various credit schemes, and then you have more embedded notions of credit, that talk about, people's own credibility amongst their, and their moral standing amongst their family or friends in their hometown. For me, like what's interesting about looking at this kind of issue is that, on one aspect is very mundane, and it's about people's financial decisions and about the ways they cope with their future, where it may be uncertain, and what role, a financialized, a formalized financial product like credit can do there. But on the other level, it links to, a much bigger moment where a concept is really seems up for grabs and seems to be there seems to be a big attempt to try to make it crystallize around certain things. So that is the hope, and we're kind of doing various bits of interviews with different groups and developing different kinds of little projects on that. So if anybody is interested, I would love to hear from them as well.
It's something to look forward to reading more about. Good. And during the time you've been here in our conversations and in your presentation in the lecture series, you've had ample opportunity to talk about your fieldwork experiences. I wonder if you would maybe just say something more generally about that process of, you've gone to very rural areas and spent considerable amount of time. Is there something you can say to us about that process?
My PhD project and my postdoc, so the Social Media in Rural China book, were both based on what might be called, and thought of as a really traditional concept of, ethnographic research. That might be a year and a half in a particular field site, very much hanging out with people. And I think one of the things about that is you always leave never quite sure if it was a success or not. Because I think you leave with all you had, a lot of the time, all you had with that during that time was experiences. And I think when you leave, you're never quite sure how you will bring these together. I had, pages of field notes and things, and looking back on those, lots of them never made sense and never got used. I think that I'd always been very lucky when I did field work, is that I was in pretty remote places, but I always had people who looked after me and helped to kind of guide me. And also my supervisor also always advised me, just spend as much of your time as you can walking around, talking to as many different people as you can. And, some of his tips I still remember to today. Like one of his tips he always gave me was, You know, if somebody in your field site says, oh, don't talk to that person over there, whatever you do, don't talk to that person, then you absolutely must go and speak to that person, because there's a really good reason why, you know, these two people see themselves as being very different from each other. So, you know, I think my supervisor always gave me that passion for being slightly inquisitive, or maybe even better way to term it would just be nosy, and to try to kind of dig away at things. So, I always really enjoyed that kind of sense of adventure that came from ethnographic fieldwork. I think one thing is also that's developed over the years. So with the social media project, because it was part of a larger project, that ethnographic fieldwork ended up having a bit more focus than, say, my PhD. So several of the researchers in other countries at the same time doing their fieldwork in other smallish places. So we ended up having a video call every month. We ended up writing our monthly fieldwork reports. And traditionally in anthropology, if you wrote such things, they would be shared with your supervisor. But, you know, we were sharing them with 10 other people who were also looking at similar topics. So that was, for me, that was a great experience, because, one of the defining features of anthropological fieldwork is often loneliness, you know, and solitariness, you know. And in a way, that's romanticized so much that, often in my PhD, I felt lost when I was in the field. So, that having a tiny bit of structure was actually, really helpful. And then, in this, in the more recent years since joining the University of Hong Kong, we kind of spoilt in a way, because, getting to mainland China is so easy. You can be on a train and be there in 7 minutes now, which is kind of mind boggling when you think about it. So, and then the other thing that is wonderful is actually, working with our students at the University of Hong Kong. So, for me, one of the biggest learning curves now has been turning my solitary research into a learning experience. But one that's like a learning experience for students and for me, because very often, we would bring Hong Kong students or other mainland students to do fieldwork, and they might be they're from cities in China. So I love that, because, when we go to a factory, they may have very different, they often we will have encounters, and they will see completely different things in the encounter to me. We normally go, go and have a coffee or go and have some tea somewhere afterwards and talk about the conversations we've just had, or the, discussions we've had with participants. And, nine times out of 10, we both come out of it with something completely different. But I don't think that necessarily means... you have some kind of big problem with your data. In fact, actually, it deepens the analysis, and somehow through that negotiation, of us with our participants, and then me with the students or other researchers, then actually I think really interesting insights like slowly bubble to the surface, and that is really fun. So I think that what is research, how do you do research, has been changing over the years, and it's an interesting kind of trajectory, and I'm sure it will keep developing in unusual ways, right?
Indeed, yeah. And those are useful, interesting insights about what structures might help mitigate some of the lost loneliness and the way these smaller groups might working together might assist each other in intellectual ways, imaginative ways as well. That's all very useful information, and I thank you for coming and sharing some of your stories and experiences and insights about your work. So I want to say I hope we get you back, and hope we get to hear more about that that continuing work soon.
No, thank you so much for having me. It's really been great to share, and it's so great all the initiatives you have here and super. The interesting speakers. So I would very much love to come back.
Lovely. Thanks thank very much, you. Tom.
Thanks.
The East Asia Program would like to thank the Language Resource Center and Sam Lupowitz for his help in recording this podcast.